It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, Al Jazeera America launches today. The new network is trying to reverse trends in American cable news with more investigative reporting and less opinion.
But first, does hot weather make you cranky and irritated?
Well, it turns out that the relationship between heat and agitation could have a pretty big impact on society as a whole.
A new study in the journal Science shows that historically, shifts in climate have led to an increase in violent conflict around the world.
And using data from the past, researchers have tried to assess how climate change today might affect levels of violence in the future.
They found that by 2050, violence between groups of people could increase by 50%.
Joining us now is Professor Edward Miguel. He's a researcher involved in the study and the Axfam Professor in Environmental and Resource Economics at UC Berkeley. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So what accounts for the connection between heat and violence?
Well, in our study, we looked at a variety of forms of violence, and we found something very striking. When you look across societies, if you look at everything from crime in U.S. cities all the way up to civil wars in Africa or riots in India, when it gets very hot, and you have other forms of extreme climate like drought, you have more violence. It's a very striking statistical relationship.
Why? What is it about heat, though, that causes this to happen?
There are a couple different explanations that the researchers in this field have looked at. So there's one set of explanations that are really psychological. There are a number of psychologists that have studied individuals in the lab, and they've basically seen what happens when you turn up the temperature in the lab, and it turns out when it gets hot, people get more aggressive, and it seems to be due to some changes in our brains, in our neurophysiology when it gets very hot. But there's a second set of explanations that are probably most important in low-income countries, and those are economic explanations. So in poor societies in rural Africa, Asia, and parts of Latin America, when it gets very hot and very dry and there's extreme climate, that's very important for those societies because they're overwhelmingly agricultural. So their crops aren't going to do well when there's very extreme climate. And when their crops fail, they enter very difficult economic times.
Hmm. So talk about your research a little bit. How far back did you go in researching this, and what groups of people were you looking at?
We tried to be as comprehensive as we could. We actually, for the first time, put together studies from many different disciplines, from economics to history, archaeology, psychology, political science. So we tried to be as comprehensive as we could across time and also across space. So we have studies on crime in the U.S. and also on violence around the world. And from archaeology and history, we were able to go back in time, sometimes a couple thousand years. I think most of your listeners know about the use of tree rings or sediment deposits to capture the way the climate was even, you know, centuries ago. So we have some studies that go far back. For instance, there's a study on the Mayan civilization in Mexico, which finds that the collapse of the Mayan civilization into really violent civil war occurred after a century of very hot and dry climate. And so, you know, even for things as important as the collapse of entire civilizations, very extreme climate can be a very important factor.
Let's dig into that a little bit. I'm curious how you can tell by looking at tree rings and sediment deposits what the climate was like at a time.
Yeah, so, you know, what ends up happening is, say, for in a given year, if temperatures are moderate and there's enough rainfall, trees grow more than they would, say, during times of worse weather. So that's how tree rings are used to get a sense of what weather was like. In terms of sediment deposits, it turns out that rainfall patterns and temperature sometimes drive the amount of things like titanium deposits or other metallic deposits in the ocean floor, in lake beds. And so what archaeologists do is they dig into these lake beds and they take out samples, and as they go back in time, you know, deeper and deeper into the sediment, they can get a sense of what climate was like even 1,000 years ago. It's pretty amazing.
Have you been able to determine whether the downfall of the Mayan civilization is just correlated with this this time in history where there was a century of hot weather, or do you know that there's a direct link between the two, a cause and effect sort of thing?
Yes. So I think, you know, just to be clear, we put together 60 studies across disciplines, and we subjected them to some statistical tests called meta-analysis. But these are studies by a lot of other scholars. What we did, and the condition for inclusion into our study, was that the data sets that we focused on had to be very rich. We basically only focused on data sets that had what's called longitudinal data. In other words, we had data on a lot of different locations at a lot of different time points. And the ability to use that kind of rich data actually helps us understand the causal effect of climatic changes on violence or other forms of conflict, because we're able to parse out or account for any fixed differences, say, between different locations or any fixed differences across time. So in some of the studies that we look at, there's a very strong relationship between high temperatures and crime, violent crime in U.S. cities in hot months. Those analyses don't rely on a comparison of, Madison, Wisconsin versus Miami. Any kind of average difference between Madison and Miami is differenced out. So the statistics we're able to use with these rich data sets gives us a lot more confidence that what we're getting at is a true causal effect of temperature. Basically, what we're saying is in a very hot year in Miami, a very hot July, say, there's more crime compared to a cooler July in Miami. That's really what a lot of these relationships are based on, is that kind of longitudinal variation.
And you mentioned that there might be a biological explanation for this, so that when you look at people in a scientific environment and turn up the heat on them, that their behavior changes. Why does that happen?
You know, there's no consensus on the exact mechanism among the psychologists. There's been a lot of discussion about exactly what the neurophysiological changes might be. But what is very clear in a number of studies is that behavior does change and does become more aggressive at these higher temperatures. But one of the things we call for in this paper is more research precisely on the mechanism, so we can better understand exactly what those channels are. But the lab studies are actually really fascinating. There's a lab study on a police training course, and some psychologists actually varied the temperature that police faced in the different rooms as they were going through a training simulator, basically facing a computer screen. They had to decide when to simulate pulling a weapon or how to respond to a potential incident. And the police in the very hot room responded much more aggressively than the police in the cooler training simulation room. So there's some really interesting findings out there.
Yeah, that is interesting. That's another layer to this. So is there an actual estimation as to how much violence will increase with, you know, every rising degree in the temperature over time?
There is, and that's one of the contributions of our paper, is to try to combine all these dozens of different studies to try to come up with some overall numbers. We divided the studies into a couple different groups. We focused on the one hand on what we call interpersonal violence, so things like violent crime, and on the other hand, intergroup violence, things more like civil wars or riots, really society-wide phenomena. And we analyzed those different studies separately because they're somewhat different phenomena. When we look at the interpersonal violence, like crime, in the U.S., the best sort of estimates we have is that if we go out to about 2050, the climate science predicts the world is going to warm by about 2 degrees Celsius. So that's almost 4 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's a pretty large average warming. Our best estimate is violent crime will increase by somewhere between 5 to 10% over that time period. When we look at the intergroup violence, and a lot of those studies and a lot of the data sets we have there are from low-income countries in Africa, Asia, Latin America, there are much bigger effects. So the prediction there is that intergroup violence might increase by 40 to 50% over the next half century or so. Conflicts in those settings are very, very sensitive to high temperature.
And just in our last minute here, is there any way to mitigate the violence levels? I mean, for example, is even being aware of it one step toward, proactively trying to work against it?
We think so. And I think that's really the million-dollar question, is what to do next. When it comes to thinking about low-income societies for whom high temperatures and drought conditions really are a major economic calamity, there are some types of policies that could help. So developing new drought-resistant and high-temperature-resistant crops would be a very important way forward. But as you said, even understanding the relationship can be a starting point. If police chiefs are just much more aware of how crime spikes when the temperature is high. Maybe they can devise some better policing strategies, putting more police on the streets when the weatherman says it's going to be very hot.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for telling us about your study.
Thanks a lot for having me.
That was Edward Miguel. He is a professor in environmental and resource economics at UC Berkeley.
And now we'll check the headlines, and then we'll talk about the launch of Al Jazeera America today, a network that hopes to make a splash in the cable news biz. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks, Kristen. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Al Jazeera is launching its American network today and is hoping to be a game changer in American cable news.
Back in January, they purchased Current TV for $500 million and have since then been preparing for today's launch.
Al Jazeera already has Arabic and English-speaking news channels that have been successful around the world.
Here to talk with us about the new network is Brian Stelter. He covers television and digital media for the New York Times, and he's the author of Top of the Morning. Thank you for joining us, Brian.
Thank you.
So Al Jazeera America seems to be branding itself as a hard-hitting, serious news network. It's going to have less opinion, less advertising. Can we expect them to deliver on all this?
They seem to have just started to do that. They've been on the air for about an hour now. And one of the things that's noticeable is an emphasis on serious, hard news. Another thing that's noticeable is fewer commercials. And that speaks to one of two things. One thing is that the channel is funded by the Emir of Qatar, which has seemingly limitless funds for Al Jazeera, thanks to the oil and gas reserves in that country. And then number two, they are having some hard time, it seems, attracting advertisers. And so as a result, they're depending less on ads and more on the subsidy from the government.
Well, as long as you brought up ads, part of the Al Jazeera story that we're hearing is that, you know, maybe they don't need the ads that much. They are financed to the teeth,
That's right. Well, they are like in the BBC or Russia Today or Chinese state television. They're subsidized by a government, so they don't have the same financial pressures as commercial networks in this country like CNN or Fox News or MSNBC. They do say, though, that they are, their goal, like any other channel, is to make money, even though they do have wealthy backers. They're trying to get a subscriber fee from cable distributors, just like Fox or MSNBC, and they're trying to have advertisers as well. But it's hard to launch a new channel these days, very hard, and Al Jazeera's success or failure will be measured years from now, not anytime soon.
Now tell us a little bit about who's funding Al Jazeera and how that's different from other cable news networks.
You look at CNN or Fox News, these are channels that are owned and operated by big media companies like Time Warner in CNN's case or the News Corporation in Fox News' case. They expect to make a profit and do big profits every quarter. Al Jazeera is different because it's funded by Qatar. And because Qatar created Al Jazeera, the Arabic channel, almost 20 years ago, in order to have more influence in the Middle East and around the world. And it's done that. It's been very successful. It's one of the preeminent Arab broadcasters. Probably the preeminent Arab broadcaster. And its English language channel, called Al Jazeera English, is also very well respected in other parts of the world. But Al Jazeera English never succeeded in getting on in the United States. Companies like Comcast and Time Warner Cable generally refused to carry Al Jazeera English. That's why Al Jazeera went out and bought Al Gore's Current TV for an estimated $500 million. That way, it basically bought the right to have a channel in the United States that companies like Comcast would carry. So now, as of today, you can watch Al Jazeera America, this brand new channel, in about half of the homes that have cable or satellite. Not quite half, but almost half. The rest of us will have to wait until the cable company we have either decides to carry it or until there's more availability of it on the Internet.
And is that likely to happen anytime soon as far as streaming goes?
Not in the short term. Maybe in the long term, though. There's been a lot of complaints online today because Al Jazeera took down the live stream that they used to provide to American viewers. It's the kind of thing that didn't have a big audience, but the people that liked it really, really liked it. It kind of like PBS. Their newscast is not that popular, but it's really, really loved by people who watch it. And that's what Al Jazeera wants to be, they say, in the United States. They want to kind of be a 24-hour version of the news hour on PBS. They want to be a sober, sophisticated, serious newscast around the clock. And if they succeed, well, that'll be a big addition to the media landscape here in the United States.
Now, what you're describing and what Al Jazeera America says it's going to be, it reads like a journalism professor's best dream ever.
You know, it really does.
This is going to be a cable network that doesn't have to worry about money. It doesn't have to worry about advertising. If it's a good story, they can tell it. They don't have to worry how much it costs. And they're going to be serious about it. There's not going to be a lot of ads. I mean, if they succeed, what does that mean about media in America? Because we hear a lot of gloom and doom these days.
And, you know, and on the other hand, you do hear people, you'll hear people on message boards or people at diners when I ask them about media, you know, they'll say to me, I want a more reliable, less opinionated, less entertaining version of the news. I just want to know the facts. That's what Al Jazeera hopes is true. We'll find out if there really is an audience that actually wants to watch that. You know, after all, the BBC is sort of available in the United States, but not really. PBS is available, but it has a reputation for being older, you know, skewing older, maybe less appealing to young people. So Al Jazeera is coming along, presenting this almost as an experiment, you know, an experiment of sorts to find out, will people tune in for a straightforward, no-nonsense take on what happened today in the U.S. and in the world? And maybe a couple of years from now, if we looked at the ratings, we'll know if people are interested in that or not.
Are they likely to make it a couple years in if the ratings are down?
I think they will. I think they'll be here for the long term. Whether the numbers, whether the ratings are there immediately or not, they have made such a big investment here, many hundreds of millions of dollars, and they're going to continue to do that in the years to come, for a couple of reasons. One, Al Jazeera is pretty much available elsewhere in the world, so it believes it's important to be here in the United States as well. And to go back to the point about it being a dream come true for journalism professors, it really is almost like an employment act for journalists right now. I haven't seen this kind of investment in television news since Fox News and MSNBC launched, and that was back in the 90s. They've hired 900 people for this network, 400 of whom are editorial employees, which means anchors and producers and reporters. You know, that's the kind of investment that a lot of other journalists look at and really cheer. Whether they support Al Jazeera or not, whether they compete with it or want to watch it, it's a positive moment for journalism because of that investment that's happening. Of course, there are concerns about how the content will be presented. There's questions about bias. There's questions about point of view. And those are questions, of course, that follow every channel and every news report. They're unique in this case because of Al Jazeera's funding, because of its roots in the Middle East.
Now, Al Jazeera may not be terribly concerned about how many people are watching because they don't have to worry about money so much as we've been talking about. But if they don't have viewership, they're not going to have influence. That's one thing. And then I guess the other strand of that is that, you know, is Al Jazeera just out of the gate going to be stigmatized because America's first introduction has been the Osama bin Laden tapes back around September 11th?
That is going to be one of the steepest challenges they face. There is still a reputation that Al Jazeera faces in some pockets of the United States. In fact, I've noticed in a lot of the media coverage about Al Jazeera America launching that it's still the issues are still brought up. For example, you'll still hear people say, is it the terrorist network? Or people will say, is it anti-American? You know, those kinds of labels are usually unfair about anything. Things are always more complicated than they appear. But it's true that 10 years ago, this was the channel that was broadcasting audio tapes by Osama bin Laden. This was the channel that was showing civilian deaths in Iraq in a way that United States networks weren't. And it was a channel that was demonized by the Bush administration for being anti-American. I think some viewers will look past that and decide for themselves, while others will be much more skeptical. Of course, Al Jazeera points out that there's been a lot of foreign brands that have come into the U.S., faced skepticism, and succeeded. They point to Honda. They point to Toyota. They point to all those sorts of brands that were once viewed critically but are now embraced. We'll see if Al Jazeera can be one of those.
Now, just got about 40 seconds or so left, but what has been a response from the other prevailing princes of the cable news arena? It seems like it's kind of a shrug so far.
You shrug is exactly the word that one of the heads of one of the networks used when talking to me about this. None of them will go on the record and criticize Al Jazeera or welcome Al Jazeera. I've been struck by the lack of on the record comments about this new competitor. But I think everybody at the other broadcast networks, cable news networks, is looking at this a little with a lot of curiosity, a little bit of skepticism, and frankly, a bit of a dismissive tone. I'm not sure they think there's room for another network like this, but Al Jazeera is going to try to make room.
All right. Well, we'll be watching, and I'm sure you will be too. Brian, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Brian Stelter, TV and digital media reporter for the New York Times. And what about you? Would you watch Al Jazeera? Will you watch it if it's available on your cable providers? Tell us what you think on the Central Time Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow, we'll talk to one of the photographers featured in the Milwaukee Art Museum's exhibition called Wisconsin 30.
And then we'll hear how a mandate enacted a year ago called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival has affected young immigrants.
And then we'll be talking with a nutritionist about that slump that tends to hit around 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Your energy flags and you get ready to go home or take a nap, talking about how to beat that.
That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll hear how being overqualified for your job can lead to poor mental health. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Master crime novelist Elmer Leonard died today at the age of 87. Critics say he elevated the reputation of the thriller and gave it literary status. He's known for his bestsellers Glitz and Out of Sight, among numerous others. And we tip our hat to Elmer Leonard now with this clip from Get Shorty.
Hey, where's my coat?
It's not one of these?
Hey, where's my coat?
It's not one of these.
Well, do you see a black leather jacket? Fingertip length, like the one Pacino wore in Serpico? Because if you don't, you owe me $379.
Well, maybe you didn't see the sign.
I seen the sign, but I didn't come to sunny Florida to freeze my ass off. You got that? So you either find my coat, or you give me the $379 that my ex-wife paid for it at Alexander's.
Rino, vieni qui, puoi spiegare a questo signore, il signor Barboni, si è prestato il
coat solamente. Ray Bones took my coat?
No, no, he didn't take it. He borrowed it. Oh, see, somebody took his coat. So Mr. Barboni tried this other coat, and it fit him pretty good.
That was my coat.
He was wearing it to go home, but he's not going to keep it.
No. My car keys are in that coat.
Mr. Barboni is a good customer. You know, he works for Jimmy Cab.
I know who he works for. Where's your phone?
Well, what about you? Do you have a favorite Elmer Leonard book or a scene from a movie? You can let us know on the Central Time Facebook page.
As unemployment levels remain high in the United States, even those who manage to find jobs can sometimes find themselves underemployed, meaning they're overqualified for their positions. A new study actually suggests that overeducation can have a negative effect on mental health.
And we're going to be taking your calls during this segment. Do you work in a job that you're overqualified for, and how does it make you feel? Would you rather be challenged? You can call in and share what you do and what you might choose to do to make your job more fulfilling at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can share your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page.
Joining us is Rachel Rettner. She's a senior writer at Live Science. Rachel, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
So what does it mean that too much education can actually negatively affect mental health?
Well, it's not the education per se, but it's a mismatch between the amount of education that you have and the amount that's needed by your job. So I reported on a study that was conducted by researchers at Ghent University in Belgium, and they looked at this idea of over-education, or having more years of education than your job requires. And they found that people who were over-educated were more likely to experience symptoms of depression than people who were people who were educated but had a job that matched their skill level.
So how common an issue is that right now?
Well, this study, it didn't look at the frequency. It was just looking at this, finding this link. And the study was actually conducted by using information surveys in 2006 from Europe. It didn't look at the United States.
Mm-hmm. So is there some correlation to education encouraging you to ask more profound questions that could make you depressed, or is it more that people are overqualified for their jobs?
Well, it's important to point out this study can't tell us the reason for why over-education is linked with mental health distress. because the study was at a single point in time, so it can't tease out the cause and effect of this link. But there are some ideas about why over-education might be linked with mental health distress. And one idea is that people who are over-educated may feel less challenged in their jobs and feel as though they can't use the skills that they've acquired in their education. And that might contribute to distress. And they may also have jobs that they feel have less prestige or status than they should have, which might be a source of stress. And they may also have lower paying jobs than they would have if they weren't overeducated. And so that may also contribute to distress. And although this study found that financial hardship couldn't explain all of the link between overeducation and mental health distress, and so there's likely other factors involved besides just financial factors.
Mm. Generally speaking, though, scientists used to think that education was always good for mental health. Can you explain why?
Because studies had shown that up to a certain point, education appeared to be good for mental health, because studies have found that people with more education were at lower risk for depression compared to people with less education. And we don't know why that is, but one idea is that people who have more education might be employed in higher paying jobs, and so they would have more economic resources and they would have less job security. So the study that I reported on was looking at the question of whether mental health benefits are limitless. The mental health benefits to education are limitless, and it found that that they're not limitless, that the limit might come when you have the situation of over-education.
Mm-hmm. So is this a problem on the supply side, meaning people are getting too much education, or on the demand side, meaning that jobs are becoming, less demanding?
Well, the researchers I spoke with said that this is a supply-driven problem. There's an increase in the supply of highly educated people without necessarily there being an increase in the demand for the jobs that require that education.
We're talking with Rachel Rettner. She is senior writer at Live Science about this new study finding that people who are overqualified for their jobs actually have a higher likelihood of poor mental health. We're taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Let's take a call from David in Ironwood, Michigan. Hi, David.
Hello. One of my jobs is giving out samples at Walmart. I have two associate degrees, IQ of 130. I think the main thing as far as when you know more what your boss does and you have all this extra time to think about things about how the global warming is affecting the planet and stuff, and you know this stuff because you're educated and you're in a position where you don't have much power to affect things because of your low economic status and stuff. You just want to bang your head against the wall sometimes. I mean, if they just listen to people, you know, just because I have a low-paying job doesn't mean I don't know nothing, you know.
And David, did you used to have a full-time job, and how would you compare
a long time ago. When I worked for the state of Minnesota as a computer operator, that was back in 78. And I also worked for a bank, TCF, whatever, as a computer operator. I actually earned more. That's the highest paid ever got in real dollars. No adjusting for inflation. I mean, I actually earned more back in the highest wage, I think, was 1981.
Okay, but
most I ever
in
earned.
Terms
ever
of
since then, it's been downhill.
In terms of your mental health and your general happiness, though, have you noticed a change now that you're working part time?
If I could just get enough to pay the bills, that would do a lot, you know? And also, if, you know, by some of my bosses who probably know less than me, just listen to some of my ideas, you know? Just because they're the boss, they think they know everything, and just, you know, just that thing, being listened to and having enough to make your bills,
mm-hmm.
and I'd be happy.
Well, thank you so much, David, for telling us about that. Rachel, I'm hearing another side to this then, is that in addition to maybe not having enough to do and not being challenged mentally or intellectually, that some employees are also enduring a lot more stress because it's harder to make ends meet. Did the study look at that?
Oh, well, this study didn't look at that question because this study can't. It looked at a large population, so it didn't look at individuals, so the results don't necessarily apply to any given individual or any given situation. But that being said, when people talk about underemployment, people talk about it in different ways, but the general a general definition for underemployment is employment that doesn't meet the needs of the worker. And those needs might not be met in different ways, including not having working too little hours or having too little pay. And so, by that definition, you know, somebody who is working part time when they need to be working full time would be considered underemployed. But this study looked at over-education at more of a skill level.
We're talking with Rachel Rettner, senior writer at Live Science. Do you or someone you know work in a job that you or your friend might be overqualified for? How does it make you feel, and would you rather be more challenged? Give us a call and let us know at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thanks, Kristen. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Right now we're talking about how being overqualified for your job can lead to mental problems.
And we're wondering if you have had that experience, how being underemployed or overqualified is impacting you. Call in and share what your experience has been at 1-800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. We're talking with Rachel Rettner. She's a senior writer at Live Science. And Rachel, before the break, we heard from David in Ironwood, Michigan, the other part of his call. He talked about feeling underappreciated by his boss and that he is not being listened to. And did the study talk about how underappreciation on an emotional level also impacts mental health?
This particular study didn't look at that question, and again, the study was of a population, so the effect situation might be different for any given individual. So any given individual might experience the situation differently.
Okay, let's take a call from Courtney in Middleton. Hi, Courtney.
Hi. I was just going to comment and say I'm in the age bracket of 25 to 35. And when I was in high school, we were assured that if you went to college, if you got a higher education, you would get a good job. And that is a promise that isn't being fulfilled. And I think that feeling of failure just simply because you can't get that higher job is really a factor. And I'm thinking that probably leads to just a lot of stress and depression.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, what about that? The expectations of people entering the workforce are a little bit different from the reality.
Some studies that have looked at underemployment found that people who were underemployed, people who were underemployed by status, which means that they had a job that they didn't feel they felt like they should have sort of a job with higher status. So if they had a job with a lower status and they were over-educated for that job, that they were at increased risk of depression as well. So that ties back into the idea that maybe underemployment by status might be one factor in that risk of depression.
So on the other hand, there might be some people out there, the lucky few who might have landed a job that is more challenging to them, or you could spin it in the language we've been using today, that they have too little education for the job that they have. Does that also have a negative effect or no?
having too little electricity. Yeah, it does. So in the study I reported on, people who were overeducated, they actually had fewer symptoms of depression than people who were less educated.
Let's take a call from Justin in West Allis. Hi, Justin.
Hi.
What's your question or comment?
I just was calling. I know one of the things that I face, I went to school for chemistry at Marquette, and one of the things I always felt is when I went into job interviews and stuff, the jobs that I was offered coming out of college were very low level, where I felt like I was just overeducated for the fact that I understood higher degrees of thinking than what they were asking for. And I think that was part of the problem, is that you just get overeducated almost because of the inflation of degrees that are necessary to get entry-level jobs.
What about that, Rachel?
So, again, each person is going to experience the situation in a different way. So the effect of overeducation will be different from the individual. But again, when we were talking earlier about this being a supply-driven problem, meaning that people are continuing to get the advanced degrees and there might not necessarily be a demand for that job.
Mm-hmm. Melody in Brookfield is with us now. Hi, Melody.
Hi. I'm actually a bartender. I went through, private school and private liberal arts college and all of that, expecting to have some sort of a job, and this is my job now. But I found that I actually really enjoy it. I guess I'm one of the unlucky ones. One of the things that has helped me the most, because I do go through waves of, oh, gosh, is this my life? Is this what I'm doing now? Is letting go of what I feel is some sort of stigma attached with a lot of these jobs. Is saying, this isn't the job that I thought I was going to have. This isn't the job that my parents thought I was going to have. But it's a job. And I'm really lucky, and there are other things I can do to sort of keep my brain from getting bored.
Yeah. So what are you doing, Melody, to mitigate that? Are you finding ways to challenge yourself at work?
Well, at work, it's actually, the nice thing about bartending is it's a challenge that, in and of itself, it's kind of different. It's not active, conscious brain work. But I do leave feeling mentally and physically exhausted, so that's good. But mostly I keep researching things. I keep learning things. I keep trying to teach myself in ways that, I might be naturally challenged in those ways if I had a different job, but I don't. So.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that by doing that, that you're actually, your passion for your job is growing? Or,
yeah,
okay, good. Well, thank you so much go on.
Sorry. No, that's pretty much it.
Okay, well, thank you so much for calling, Melody. So having seen the results of the study, what do you think people should do about do to feel better about their work?
Well, there's, everybody each individual is going to, experience the situation of overeducation differently.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Great. Our phone number is 1-800-642-1234, and Nancy in Grafton has called us. Hi, Nancy.
Well, good afternoon. My daughter works at a facility, a healthcare facility, and she operates activities. Well, she came in, she was a helper for somebody else, but that person left, and she was doing it now for over a year all by herself, so they decided to get a new person in to help. Well, she finds out that they're offered the person that applied more money, more salary than my daughter gets, and she, how do you handle that? I mean, the other person did not take the job, so she says, I feel kind of bad. She's supposed to be working under me, but they were offered her more money. What about that?
Yeah. Nancy, what consolation did you offer her?
Well, I told her, go to your superiors and tell them that you know that, and you wanted to know if they felt that she was worthy of an increase in wages, you know, in her. That's what I told her. I said, don't just mope about it. Go take step forward and tell them what you think.
Yeah, did she do that?
Well, I don't know if it happened this week or not.
You'll have to check with her,
So far, I know she's still working there.
Okay. Well, Nancy,
but
thank you
so much. She loves her job, you know. She loves the job. She loves the people.
Well, that's good. You know, that's more than a lot of people can say. So that's great news. Thank you so much, Nancy.
Sure.
Rachel Rettner, I'm wondering if the study looked at a difference between among men versus women in terms of their mental health. I know, you know, it seems as though we hear about how women are a little bit less likely to assert themselves and ask for a salary negotiation, and in not doing so, perhaps that could lead to some frustration at work. Did you see any difference in the results among men and women in that way?
No, the study didn't give results broken down by men and women, but it is a finding that women are more likely to experience depression, and so the study took that into account. Researchers took that into account in the study, but they didn't break down the results by men and women.
And on account of this, are scientists recommending that people don't go to college, or, you know, what's the takeaway from this?
Well, the researchers I spoke with, they said they didn't consider the expansion of higher education a bad thing, but they said that often labor markets or the supply of jobs is slow to catch up to the increasing number of highly educated people, and that might lead to lack of jobs for those people. And so the researcher told me that you need an upgrading of the labor market or an increase in the job supply that needs to happen at the same time as an increase in the number of highly educated people.
Great. Well, Rachel Rettner, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Rachel Rettner is a senior writer at Live Science, and she joined us today to talk about a study about how over-education and being overqualified for your work might actually impact your mental health. We have linked to that study on the Facebook page, so you can check it out on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'd love to hear your experiences in the workplace as well. We're living in a time of topsy-turvy economics, and that affects the way we work and the way we live our lives. What are the times and the jobs that you felt most fulfilled at work? Did it have anything to do with feeling that your education matched your job? And share those experiences, those stories, on the Central Time Facebook page. And don't forget, you can also keep up with us there, find out what's coming up, and join the Central Time community. You can also call the Central Time hotline, which you can find online.
We invite you to join us on the Ideas Network after 4 o'clock. If you suffer from the afternoon slumps in energy, join us tomorrow after 4 o'clock to find out how your nutrition might actually help you maintain good energy.
Next is the news, and then we have another segment in our nostalgia series. We'll be talking about old dictionaries. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.